you don't put off maintenance on your car and think it's going to run forever. And that's what America's done. For the longest time, we've kicked this can down the road, and you know, we've run out of road.
What makes them tick? When I used to teach organizers more directly, I used to say, think of it like falling in love.
There's going to have to be a massive concerted effort to support young people who've missed the opportunity to make smooth transitions from education to work. And initiatives that are being discussed by UK political parties include some very interesting ideas.
You have no idea how I am as a nurse. And many of those managers, especially nurses that are working nights, they never see how these nurses perform. And so it's completely unfair to have a discretionary portion of a raise.
I just think the Department of Labor has just been very lenient with employers, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to order companies to pay more. They just want them to pay the money back.
We want to say that the military is safe when they're sending us to shed our blood in these endless wars. When they're killing our people, like Vanessa Guillen, like Asia Graham, like Elder Fernandez, and then they don't want to give us fucking answers, and we don't want to shut down bases like Fort Hood.
There was no way that I thought I was going to do this. At 18, opportunity opened up, and I still was like, I don't want to do this. No way. I don't want to get dirty. I remember my dad coming home filthy. No, thank you. I don't want to do that.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from some of the more than 100 shows that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. On today's show, Steelworkers Union President Tom Conway on President Biden's American Jobs Plan and the need to invest in the nation's infrastructure. Unite Here, Local 11 organizer and co-president Susan Minato talks about growing up as the daughter of working-class Japanese parents and how the lessons her mother taught her helped shape Unite Here's training model. Professor Mel Sims from Glasgow University discusses the scarring effect of a recession on the career trajectories of young people and some possible solutions. Registered nurse Leslie Egan describes nursing in Albany during the pandemic. We explore the problems of rampant wage theft and poor enforcement by the Department of Labor with Center for Public Integrity senior reporter Alexia Fernandez-Campbell and Terry Gerstein, a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Law School Labor and Work-Life Program. Then, three union veterans discuss the connection between the military and the class system. And we wrap up this week's show with filmmaker Mark Street and longshoreman Maureen Gutierrez on Mark's new film, Work Songs. We've got reports today from Solidarity Works, Welcome to Union Town and Union Dues, Union Strong, Monday Morning QB and Working People, and the Docker Podcast. I'm Chris Garlock for the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Here's the show, beginning with the Solidarity Works podcast from the United Steelworkers of America.
I'm here with USW President Tom Conway, and we're talking about the American Jobs Plan. President Biden said this would be the largest jobs investment in America since World War II. What does that mean for the nation? Both historically speaking and right now at this critical moment, kind of mid-pandemic?
Well, while a lot of it's pandemic-driven because we find ourselves in sort of this immediate economic crisis of having to recover from that, this didn't come about because of the pandemic. It came about a decade of inattention to and failure to invest in the nation's critical infrastructure. And so the roads didn't crumble overnight or because of the pandemic and the bridges and all the traditional infrastructure issues that need to be repaired. You know, it's a function of having not put any work into it. And so in the sense that this being the largest investment since World War II, I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's absolutely critical that we do it. I mean, look, you don't put off maintenance on your car and think it's going to run forever. And that's what America's done. For the longest time, we've kicked this can down the road, and, you know, we've run out of road.
The president is calling on Congress to invest $50 billion to create a new office at the Department of Commerce dedicated to monitoring domestic industrial capacity. And we're hearing a lot about this, a lot about the critical supply chain. What is that, and how does it factor into an infrastructure plan?
Oh, look, if we make the mistake of investing in our infrastructure, but we don't invest in the materials and the methods and the manufacturing to do that, and we instead decide to buy it somewhere else and go buy bridges from China or go buy materials from offshore, or as we did in the last go around in wind, buy all the nacelles out of Denmark or Europe or Asia. And to the degree that the United States has embraced solar energy, we have not built any of it. And so it comes here and we get the installation work. And the installation work, you know, on a solar panel, it's a day and a half work. That's what we get out of it. We didn't get any of the manufacturing of it, of the making of it, of the materials that go into it. So critical supply chain is just that. If we're going to rebuild this country, we need to rebuild it from top to bottom, and we need to be in the supply chain making those materials. You know, right now the nation's talking about a lot of offshore wind potential along the eastern seaboard. And 2,000 to 4,000 offshore wind turbines, and the work that will go into that will last for decades. And so we need to be able to supply that. We can't have that coming, landing on our shores, made somewhere else. And so I think that's a critical component of this, because that's where we're going to get long-term sustainable careers for people to develop those products, to develop the manufacturing, to develop the artificial intelligence that's going to be involved, to learn the skills and to upskill the workforce where necessary. And that's the kind of post-World War II boom that this can produce. And I think this administration understands that, and that's what their intent is to do.
At the end of the day, Americans in all communities and workers in all sectors are counting on a people-focused investment that will not just repair the foundation of the country, but prepare it for the long haul.
I think the thing that doesn't get talked about enough is, what's the cost to our country if we don't do it? Where do we find ourselves 10 years from now if we decide in this moment we're not going to fix the country and we're just going to harvest out what we can? We're just going to keep falling further and further behind, and that eventually affects your GDP, affects your earnings, and affects how effective you can be as a nation, as an economy, and how workers can thrive. So the cost of not doing this is just tremendous, and we see it happening around us every day.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode. Until next time, take care and stay safe, siblings.
union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town, a union town. All down the line, this is a union town.
This is President Ron Herrera, and you are listening to Welcome to Uniontown, a podcast that delves into the everyday issues, iconic leaders, and allies of the labor movement.
Today we welcome to Uniontown Susan Minato. She is the co-president of Unite HERE Local 11, which represents more than 30,000 workers in the hospitality industry in Southern California and Arizona. Susan is a fourth-generation Japanese-American. She started her career in worker justice as a labor lawyer for the Utility Workers Union and later left law to become an organizer.
Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, Ron. Good morning, Ugo. Nice to hear your voices again.
Thanks for being here, Susan. You're also a national leader in your own right, someone who's accomplished a lot. But we wanted folks to first know Susan, the coming of age Susan, right? And we want to hear how you came into the labor movement, beginning first with your origins in New Jersey.
Well, I'm actually from a California family, both sides. And so my mother's family in 1888 came over to the Bay Area, and she was born in Sacramento. And then my father's family came over from Japan in probably the turn of the century. And so both are came to California. My dad's family was living in LA. I only ended up in New Jersey because after the Japanese internment during World War II, my mother and father were teenagers still, didn't know each other. And each family migrated after the internment to New Jersey because there was a farm and a frozen food factory there that was recruiting cheap Japanese labor out of the camps, because the Japanese had nowhere to go. They had lost everything. So this farm gave free tickets to any Japanese American from the camp who would want to come work. They'd get a job on the farm or in the factory, and they'd get set up with a company grocery account. They'd get set up in company housing. They'd get company credit for, you know, the basics. And so thousands of Japanese families went there, and that's why I was born there.
It sounds like maybe you were born to your parents' lived experiences. How did them experiencing the internment camps and being farm workers inform how they raised you?
You know, my parents and grandparents were like extremely humble. You know, for better, for worse, they were taught you keep your head down and you just get along and you don't need to rock any boats. And, you know, you just kind of have to reintegrate back into society, because that was, you know, how they felt in the 40s. And then my mother, she comes from a really interesting family because they're very unusual people. It's hard to explain exactly how they're unusual, but they are from a samurai family, and they just, you know, have certain principles that they live by. And even though they didn't, you know, really want to rock the boat as their parents taught them, they also felt like, I think internally, like they were going to stand up for themselves, at least in some smaller ways. I was very influenced by my mother, who was very strong, like so strong, and taught me from the beginning that, I mean, I could even hear her words today. She would say, you know what? You are just as good as everybody else. I know you, and you can do anything that you want. And she told me that my whole life. And so while she was sort of still practicing this idea that, you know, you somewhat keep your head down, she was kind of like secretly passing me all these messages like, but on the other hand, you know, you don't take shit. So it was kind of a great thing. She was a union member.
This is a great opportunity to share about the leadership development model of Unite HERE. Could you share about what that is and why it's so successful?
I started in 93 at Local 11. A lot of things weren't built yet. Mm-hmm. So I sort of ended up doing a lot of the training model at Local 11 based on the training model that Carl Lechow put together in the International. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to knowing a person, but not just knowing their name and where they went to school or where, you know, this kind of stuff, but really learning about them, what makes them tick. when I used to teach organizers more directly, I used to say, think of it like falling in love. You know, you have to know about them. You have to know how they think, what they feel. And so when you ask them to do very difficult things, like go on strike, like put their families on the line due to, you know, striking or whatever, that they're there. Yes means yes, or their no means no. And show them that, you know, without insulting them, that their life can be different. They can go up, they can change, they can be better. It's a very deep understanding of the person first, and then giving appropriate actions and assignments that push them up a little bit, not too far to the point where they run away, but like commensurate with how they're feeling and, you know, they're what they've been exposed to.
Thank you, sister. Appreciate you. You know that. And we got a lot of work ahead of us, and
I see success.
I see success.
And we're going to have a lot of fun too.
Oh yes, that too. Thank you, Susan, for getting on.
Of course. Thank you.
This is a union town, a union town. All down the line. This is a union town, a union town. All down the line. This is a union town.
Hey, this is President Ron Herrera, thanking you and my co-host, Brother Hugo Romero, for joining us on this episode of Welcome to Uniontown.
Welcome to the Union Jews Podcast. The UK's only All Things Union podcast, designed for your downloadable, digital delight and appreciation. In this episode, tech workers get unionized in Utah. That's a tech workers union, not a state in the US. Mel Sims on why we cannot forget the young. The Labour Research Department gives us the lowdown on home working after the pandemic. And Josiah Mortimer has his radical roundup. Hello, hello, welcome. Welcome to Union Jews, the UK's only All Things Union podcast. I'm Simon Sapper, the indomitable Professor Mel Sims, Professor of Work and Employment at the University of Glasgow, with her thought for the week this week, musing on why we could never, forget younger workers. First, let's turn to Mel. Mel Sims, Professor of Work and Employment, University of Glasgow. Now, when it comes to young workers, I think we would all acknowledge that they've paid a heavy price in terms of employment or lack of employment during the pandemic. Younger workers, you know, dominate the workforce when it comes to hospitality and when it comes to retail. Those two sectors have really taken a hammering, even more so than many other economic sectors. Large numbers of people have lost their jobs already. Large numbers of young people still on furlough. And it's a very hard, challenging time for them. Now, as Mel will tell us, in a piece recorded before the outcome of the Scottish elections were known, the impact on employment when you're young can last much longer than just the period when you are out of work or looking for work.
May is often the time for elections in the UK, so I've been reviewing the policies of the main parties standing in Scotland. And whoever wins, it's clear that the scale of the challenges ahead are huge here and around the world. I think it absolutely goes without saying that the priority for all governments is to make sure that COVID is under control and the economy starts to reopen. That will obviously reduce pressures on the state to subsidise businesses and workers, particularly in sectors where they've had to cease trading. But once things do open up, there's still going to be a huge job ahead, even if the anticipated consumer boom does get going. The problem is that all the evidence from previous recessions shows that many young workers never really catch up if they move out of education into a labour market that's in recession. And that's sometimes what we call a scarring effect, because the consequences of that can be seen in all sorts of economic and well-being data throughout someone's life. So there's going to have to be a massive concerted effort to support young people who've missed the opportunity to make smooth transitions from education to work. And initiatives that are being discussed by UK political parties include some very interesting ideas around things like a young person's job guarantee, supporting specific sectors such as retail and hospitality, which are often the first destinations for young workers moving into employment. Ideas like paid internships are also being discussed, particularly for graduate workers. And of course, many parties are looking at the whole structure of skills and vocational training and looking at how they can invest and support that further. And all of these are important initiatives, but the thing that's missing, I think, from the agenda at the moment is the commitment to making this an ongoing investment. So politicians, but also the rest of us, need to pledge not to forget these young people. Our lives will soon start to return to something that looks a bit more like normal, but they are going to need to continue to have support from the state, but also from the rest of us as employers, managers, colleagues, friends and family. And that, if you like, is the job of work ahead of us as well as politicians.
Thanks for that, Mel. Really important issue that's raised there, because if there is this scarring effect and there is consistent literature over decades that demonstrates there is a scarring effect in the way that Mel has described, and you can find links to some of those papers, by the way, in the companion blog to this podcast, which you can find over on the makesyouthink.com website. So if we have the scarring effect, what do we do about it? The kind of conventional wisdom, again, is you are very careful about how much you pay younger workers because you don't want to price them out of the labour market. You don't want to price them out of a job. And I intuitively feel uncomfortable about that, I have to say. I don't know about you, listeners. There is a debate to be had about what the appropriate response is to the risk or the actuality of youth unemployment. Of course, we could take preemptive action, couldn't we, before we even get to talking about what the right rate of pay is to maximise employment for any particular age group. We could actually take a step back and say, what preventative means can government or employers take, and it would be government more than employers, I think, to safeguard employment and income for younger workers as a particular category because of the scarring effect. And that, of course, takes a determined effort from central government. It takes proactivity. It means being on the front foot and imaginative and innovative in what you're doing. What do you think the best course of action is? What do you think should happen in order to protect younger workers from this scarring effect? You can email the show at unionjews@makesyouthink.com. You can tweet us at Jews Union. Tell us what you think. Share your views. We're all ears. Join the conversation.
For the New York State AFL-CIO, I'm Darcy Wells, and this is Union Strong. Nurses at Albany Medical Center Hospital chose to belong to a union 3 years ago. They voted overwhelmingly in favor of becoming members of NYSNA, the New York State Nurses Association. NYSNA is the largest union and professional association for registered nurses with more than 40,000 members, and they're affiliated with the New York State AFL-CIO. Oh, nice. 3 years after voting to unionize, they still don't have a contract with the hospital. One of those nurses fighting for better working conditions at Albany Med, fighting for patient safety, and who fought to save patients' lives throughout the COVID pandemic, is Liz Egan.
My name is Liz Egan, and I am a RN, or nurse, at Albany Medical Center.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with us, Liz. I asked you to be a guest on the podcast to talk about your own experience as a nurse, particularly during the height of the COVID pandemic. Here we are more than a year after the health crisis started, so I think it makes sense to first talk about the kind of nursing that you do there at Albany Med, and were you involved in this pandemic?
I am a what's called a float pool nurse, and float pool nurses in the adult world go to over 30 different units. So I was floated to COVID floors during the height of the pandemic.
And so when you reflect on what happened over this past year, what's the first thing that comes to mind? If you're meeting someone for the first time and you say, yeah, I am a nurse at Albany Med. What, I'm sure they want to hear about what you endured. What comes to mind?
Ultimately, it was terrifying. I'm a mom also of young children, and of a family and not knowing what we were getting into. And when trying to treat and take care of these patients, not knowing what we were getting exposed to ourselves, but then also trying to uphold the nursing ethics that we were taught in nursing school and doing everything we can to save lives and take care of patients. There's a lot of emotions. It was terrifying, emotional. I saw patients that didn't make it that I had. They didn't die on my watch. They ended up going to ICU and passing away there. And that was heartbreaking because you wanted to see them walk out the door. So lots of emotions, lots of confusion.
One of the things that comes in my mind is I can't imagine trying to care for someone, but you're also aware yourself of what you might be exposing yourself to. Yeah. How did you handle that?
In the beginning, definitely coming home, stripping in the garage, literally having a change of clothes, sitting in the garage, taking all my clothes off, changing there. I remember Lysoling or like using the Cavi wipes at work and taking them to the car, taking my shoes off, wiping those down, wiping everything down, and then changing in the garage. And then when I got home, I worked into the night. So luckily my kids were at home, but I couldn't really take a shower till the morning. I'd wait first thing in the morning, I'd take a shower and just pray that I wasn't going to give it to my children or my husband. And there were definitely times where there were patients that we didn't know that had it and that I was potentially exposed. And I, that 2 week waiting period where you're sitting there going, well, should I get tested? I'm not having symptoms, but should I get tested? Because you didn't want to give it to anybody. It was scary in that way.
Did now here you are 3 years into having joined with NYSNA with that frustration of not having a contract, which goes toward the working conditions. It's about better working conditions as well as other benefits. I want to ask you, what do you want people to know on the outside of the hospital, what that fight is like and trying to get to that next point?
To be 100% honest, I feel like at that hospital, it's frustrating and it's really hard, especially for the nurses that have been there a long time, to just hear them how frustrated they are. About 10 years ago, I was talking to a MP there and he said it was amazing. They would get bonuses for not calling out and there'd be incentive pay and nurses were paid well and it was a happy place. And now it's changed a lot. And for me, I had no point of reference because I was new.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to hear those stories. And it's also hard to hear that we're all heroes, but we're not awarded a contract. And right now, the issue seems to be over like pay was one of the big issues.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from my perspective, and I used to be a manager in a prior role, it's really difficult to put a performance or a discretionary raise on a nurse. And because my manager never sees me as a nurse,
mm-hmm.
She's in the flow pool office, I'm on a unit. So how does my manager say, okay, I'm going to give you the 1.25 and then, okay, you have a potential for 1.75 and oh, I think you're okay. You have no idea how I am as a nurse. And many of those managers, especially nurses that are working nights, they never see how these nurses perform. And so unless you have really specific like organizational goals to base that discretionary raise on, it's completely unfair to have a discretionary portion of a raise. So it's just frustrating because we do make that hospital go round. We keep that hospital going. Our patients love us. Our patients are frustrated for us mm-hmm. that there isn't a contract. And we just need people in the community to put the pressure on Albany Med to help us get this contract, because this contract is going to support the nurses as this hospital should, then they are not.
Right. This is Nurses Appreciation Week, Liz. So please know that we appreciate you. We appreciate all the nurses.
You.
Yes, working so hard every day. The entire labor movement does. And also, thank you. I know you have a lot going on. So thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Of course. Thank you so much.
This is Monday Morning QB, May 10th, 2021. I'm Askia Muhammad. Jobs numbers released Friday fell far short of economists' predictions. But while the experts sort through this latest hurdle to economic recovery, workers are facing some not-so-new abuses on the job. A report published by the Center for Public Integrity last week details the problem of wage theft and suggests that employers could be stealing more from workers now than before the pandemic began. But how do we solve the wage theft problem, pandemic or none? Reporter Chris Banger-Drowns has an answer.
Wage theft is when an employer steals wages from a worker, and it comes in many forms. Some workers are forced to work off the clock. Others are misclassified and therefore denied income. And some other workers have tips or wages taken outright by a thieving employer. But not all workers are equally vulnerable to wage theft. Low-income workers are particularly at risk. Center for Public Integrity senior reporter Alexia Fernandez-Campbell explains why.
They live paycheck to paycheck, and so they're more likely to be afraid of complaining. They're very dependent on their jobs. They can't just easily, like, you know, miss a week of work or anything like that. So they're more likely to either take abuse or just not understand their rights. That's why.
The problem also disproportionately impacts workers of color, immigrants, and particularly undocumented workers.
One misconception is that undocumented workers don't have these kind of labor protections, but they do. They are protected by the Fair Labor Standards Act. And you can't just not pay someone and be like, oh, well, they're undocumented, so we don't need to pay them. No, you do have to. So they're assuming that immigrants don't know that they are eligible for a minimum wage and overtime. So that's why they're particularly targeted.
The Wage Theft Report, co-authored by Alexia Fernandez-Campbell, says, quote, when a recession hits, U.S. companies are more likely to stiff their lowest wage workers, end quote. Indeed, a Rutgers University study published last year found a clear relationship between unemployment levels and minimum wage violation rates during the Great Recession of 2008. The study confirmed that Latinx, Black, women, and particularly undocumented workers faced the highest rates of wage theft. Workers are likely again facing an increased rate of theft during this pandemic recession.
So the economists believe that whenever there's any kind of recession, including the pandemic recession, that this is happening more because workers don't have as many options of where they can work and jobs are more scarce. So they're more likely to be quiet if they know they're being taken advantage of.
So what kinds of tools exist to protect against wage theft? Alexia Fernandez-Campbell's report acknowledges that the federal Department of Labor is usually effective at ensuring stolen wages are eventually returned to workers. But the report questions the department's enforcement tactics against repeat offenders. Between 2005 and September 2020, the department fined only 1 in 4 repeat offenders of wage theft and only ordered cash damages paid in 14% of those cases. Campbell says financial penalties for wage theft, especially for repeat offenders, provide a strong disincentive to steal, but that those penalties are underused.
I just think the Department of Labor has just been very lenient with employers, and they don't want to do that. They don't want to order companies to pay more. They just want them to pay the money back. So that's what it seems like to me.
Part of the enforcement problem is understaffing at the Department of Labor. The Center for Public Integrity report found that, as of February, the department had less than 800 inspectors spread across the country to enforce wage theft laws. That comes out to about 182,000 applicable workers per inspector, far less than the 10,000 workers suggested by the United Nations International Labor Organization. It appears that the federal government has room to crack down on contractors for wage theft or other abuses. A 2016 report from progressive think tank Demos found that 40% of federal contracting dollars in 2013 went to businesses with recorded workplace violations. A 2010 report from the Government Accountability Office found that over the prior 4 years, half of the 50 companies most penalized for wage and hour violations were federal contractors. This limited debarment of contractors at the federal level speaks to the need to diversify enforcement and reform into the state and local levels. Terry Gerstein has experience in that field. Gerstein is a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and director of the State and Local Enforcement Project at the Harvard Law School Labor and Work-Life Program. As former labor bureau chief for New York State, Gerstein knows how to layer state enforcement on top of the floor set by federal wage and hour standards. And she says increasingly cities, too, are getting involved in protecting workers, whether by increasing the minimum wage or crafting anti-wage theft law.
And that's really new because historically protecting workers wasn't part of what cities did for their constituents, but I think it's in part a response to the really pressing need of workers right now and the extent to which there really are widespread violations and a need to take action.
Gerstein notes that some conservative states do preempt progressive cities from engaging in some of this enforcement, but says there is room for action at all levels to fight wage theft. For Monday Morning QB, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns.
My name's Amber Mathwig, and I was in the United States Navy from 2002 to 2012. I was a master at arms or a military police officer, so I have a double negative against me as far as my military background goes. And I am now involved with About Face, Veterans Against the War, anti-war, anti-militarism in our communities, and generally, you know, speaking out against U.S. military atrocities and continuing militarism in our communities.
Hello, my name's Clark. Signed up for the U.S. Navy in September 9th, 2001, and I got out right after Katrina. I worked on minesweepers. I was E4, and I am a commercial diver now.
That's Ordex. I am a Marine Corps veteran. I served from... I went to boot camp February 2004, and I retired in 2014. I was an aviation operations specialist, so I am very well versed in the work that Lockheed Martin, very much with what the military-industrial complex does. I am the national organizer for Vets for the People.
All right. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Working People, a podcast about the lives, jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class today, brought to you in partnership by In These Times Magazine and The Real News Network, produced by Jules Taylor, and supported entirely by listeners like you. We got a really special episode for y'all today. It's been a long time in the making. All of that is my fault, but I'm so glad and so honored to be joined by Amber, Clark, and Tristes. I can't thank y'all enough for making time for this. We knew that this was a really important topic that the four of us wanted to address. It's something that our listeners have asked about a number of times, and we have covered on some episodes, right? And I'm so excited to get to know more about Amber and Tristes, and for us to come together and talk about this big thorny question of the role that the military plays in the working class, in the class system, and how questions of race and gender and imperialism, right? How all of that is folded into the day-to-day reality of what the military is, right? And who the military is. So there's a lot to unpack here. And as listeners heard at the top of this episode, the thing that actually brought us together in the first place was this recruiting ad that we all saw for the Marines.
Searching for meaning in a relentless world. Always connected, but somehow alone. Trapped by illusion. We offer another path where the battle to belong begins. Awakened by a calling. United by purpose. Defined by the cause you fight for.
is that about you? Work together, get over the hump.
No one can ever take away.
You are in this, Marine.
What it means to be among the few, the proud, the Marines.
There's something so telling there that I think connects the three stories that y'all were telling. And I'll say this and then I'll turn things back over to Amber. But you start to see how these two things start to feed into each other, how it's an interlocking system. And what I mean by that is when you live in a capitalist society that treats black and brown people like second-class citizens, that treats LGBTQ folks like second-class citizens, that treats so many folks in the poor and working class like their lives don't matter. When you live in a society that in which no one but the rich belong, then the only place that you can find that belonging is in like the military. So that's what I wanted to throw in there. And maybe turn things back over to you, Amber, and ask, what was your reaction when you saw that?
My sense of belonging in the Navy always ended up being, I have to prove myself more and more. And I was never going to be good enough to even reach a peak of being respected. I had to disavow other women. I had to become angry. I had to become strict. And all of these really went against like my own internal morals and ethics and like the way that I was brought up. So my parents are really community involved or have been really community involved ever since I was a kid. So it's not like I didn't already have a sense of that. It's that my sense of what created community was warped by the bigger picture of police are part of our community and keep us safe. The military is part of our community and keep us safe. All the while not being given information on how they destroy other communities, particularly poor and communities that consist largely of people of color and immigrant communities and all of that. And just that this ad just really hit me for a lot of different reasons. Before we started talking tonight, I was looking up the demographics of the Marine Corps because this is the first Marine Corps recruiting video I've ever seen where I can't immediately identify white men. They usually make up the bulk of Marine Corps recruiting videos. And now when they actually focus in on basis, I'm seeing women, Latinos, Latinas, black men. And the Marine Corps is pretty low on all of those in general. They do have a higher number of Latino men. Just overall, it's not an accurate portrayal. It's what the Marine Corps thinks they can be.
It is a way to purchase, right? That sense of belonging, that sense that you are a worthy citizen, right? That you belong here in the United States, that you have earned your citizenship. That there's a lot that really comes with that. And so I wanted to get your thoughts, Teresa.
To piggyback off of what Amber was saying about how society paints the military and the police as this honorable safety guard that we have out there to protect us. But immigrants are bad. In the black community, they're a bunch of rioters. And it's, but you know that throughout this pandemic, our essential workers have been immigrants. Undocumented immigrants that have been out there picking your damn fruit and your vegetables and bagging your freaking groceries, have been doing roofing on your home during these hurricanes that hit last year. The black community has been out there working as essential workers. So don't tell me that they're a threat when they're out there providing the safeguards that you need in order for your family to be safe. But we want to say that the military is safe when they're sending us to shed our blood in these endless wars, when they're killing our people like Vanessa Guillen, like Asia Graham, like Elder Fernandez, and then they don't want to give us fucking answers. And we don't want to shut down bases like Fort Hood, or we want to kill people like Adam Toledo,
or Dante Wright or George Floyd. The verdict that we got on George Floyd wasn't fucking justice. It was just. It was a just verdict, but we're still fighting for justice. And so this, what Amber was said is 100% right. They tried to paint the military and the police as safety, as this is who we go to when we're afraid. They're protecting us. No, they're not fucking protecting us. They're trying to fucking kill us. And they're trying to take our kids. They're trying to take individuals like my son to fight their damn wars so that they can get rich. And we need to stop them.
They're either going to come and point the guns at us or take our kids and have them point the guns maybe at us. The Afghan war's got like fathers with their sons and daughters. They're in the same deployment. It's just some fucking insane shit I never expected to see happen in like 2002 when I was watching troops get shipped over. And everything, it's ludicrous, just the thought of that to me, but it's happening.
Welcome back to the Docker Podcast. As usual, I don't remember what episode it is, but who cares? So today I am joined by Mark Street and returning guest, not just any guest, OG guest, like from the original, it could have been like episode one or episode two, Maureen, and I'm going to screw this up, Gutierrez.
That's right. Wow. Yeah, thank you for having me back.
Thank you for coming back, Mark. Thanks for being on the show. You got a documentary coming out May 1st, Working Songs. We're going to get to that in a few minutes. Maureen, you were able to be a part of that project. But before we get into that, before we start promoting all of that, I need to know who I'm talking to. I need a bit of background here. We didn't do much research, and that's a good thing. That means the conversation's going to be real. So, Mark, who are you? Like, tell me a little bit about yourself, brother.
Sure. My name is Mark Street, and I'm a street photographer, mainly. Filmmaker. I have made short experimental films, documentary films, some improvised narratives. I made a film in Montevideo, Uruguay. I generally gravitate towards place, two things, place and work. They're two things that fascinate me. And this movie, which is called Work Songs, sort of is inspired by Studs Terkel's book, Working, where he just interviewed workers around the world, white collar, blue collar, and asked them their satisfactions and dissatisfactions with their work. It sort of starts with a dinner table conversation. If you get together with people you know or you don't know, and you have a little bit of wine, and about 10 or 11 o'clock, and you say, what's the weirdest job you ever had? People can talk for hours. Doesn't matter who, whether you know them or not, they've always got some weird story to tell. They've always got something to say about work. It's infinitely fascinating to me. It's psychological. It's revealing.
Awesome. Maureen, who are you? Reintroduce yourself to the listeners.
All right. I'm Maureen Gutierrez. I'm Local 63. Right now I'm holding current office as business agent. I have been a longshoreman since I was 18 years old. I'm a child of a deceased. So my father was a longshoreman. My grandfather was a longshoreman, but an uncle that's a longshoreman. So I come from a longshore line. I can even say now my son is a casual. So that's a huge plus. You know, it's really neat to have him in there. My husband is also Local 13, I've been involved in the union. I've ran for business agent. I've held the office of business agent. This is my third term. I think when I did this with Mark, the Working Class Songs, I had a sister, Local 63 sister that Roxanne Lawrence that kind of got me, you know, or got Mark to me or me to Mark, whatever, you know. And when I was interviewed by him at the time, I was Local 63's a secretary. It's kind of cool. I was the first female titled officer, so that's been pretty huge. So longshore is huge for me. I know. I mean, right now with work, it's what we do the most.
You talked about you know, how Longshore is a lot like family, and it is. I mean, especially your family, deep roots in the industry, and it's kind of neat in a way that the Longshore industry got to watch your family grow, but your family got to watch the Longshore industry grow at the same time.
So my dad was 12 when he passed, but that was all that was at the table. My grandfather passed when I was like 10. My uncle, so my mom's brother, his father was a longshoreman. He's still alive. And it's so neat that I get to have these conversations with him and the huge changes that there was. My godfather, you know, is still alive. So we get to talk about things like that, the changes, automation, you know, containerization, where everything before was hard work, where there was times I was like, oh, I'm not doing that. I get it. You know, when my dad passed at 12, there was no way that I thought I was going to do this. At 18, the opportunity opened up and I still was like, I don't want to do this. No way. I don't want to get dirty. I remember my dad coming home filthy. No, thank you. I don't want to do that. I'm pretty blessed for my uncle that we've had those long, deep conversations of, he was in Local 13. So we did all that leg, you know, all that backbreaking hard work, became a clerk who was Local 63, retired from Local 63. So we've been able to have really deep conversations. And it's still neat that there are members still alive that knew my father, my grandpa, my uncle. But usually dinner talks with my uncle, I'm not sure if it's before the tequila shots with him or after, but it's usually like, you know, so-and-so, he was a SO son of a bitch, and this guy, you know, that guy, good for nothing. And it's just great because it's just totally unfiltered, you know. And then it's neat that I get to have those conversations with my husband, and even with my son. There's certain things that I tell him, you know, as a, you know, casual worker, that I look forward to those things, that those conversations that we get to have.
Dan, I want to ask you about this podcast.
Sure.
You know, Maureen was your first guest, as far as I know.
Yeah, right? That was like, it came up on my Facebook thing. I can't remember if it was 4 or 6 years ago. It might have been 6 years ago already.
Like 6 years ago.
Yeah.
What gave you this idea? What possessed you?
It was twofold. One, I stole the idea. There was some coal miners up in the Elk Valley. They were United Steelworkers. They had they started a podcast called Steel Megaphone, and when it was around, it was awesome. So I stole it from them. But I got thinking about like the nature of our work and how, you know, we used to always be, and I say we like I was there and I wasn't, because it was long before my time. But you know, you have 13 guys down in the hole, or the hall, the dispatch hall was full of people, and that's where you would bullshit, and that's where you'd get your stories, and that's where you would hear, you know, other workers talk to other workers. And the nature of our work, pushing that away, you know, there's less people in the hold. We're all individually in our machines now. I wanted a way for people to be able to hear conversations with other workers. Well, I really appreciate your guys' time. It's been awesome. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah, Dan, it was great.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1919. That was the day the Winnipeg Trades and Labor Council called a general strike. It is considered one of the most important strikes in Canadian history. Social tensions intensified as soldiers returned home in search of work, only to find skyrocketing unemployment and inflation. In Winnipeg, building trades and metal workers attempted to organize and bargain as an umbrella organization. They walked off the job at the beginning of May, appealing to the city's unions for support. And on this day in 1919, some 30,000 workers walked off the job, starting with women telephone operators. The general strike had begun. Union and non-union workers alike heeded the call. Factories shut down, public services came to a halt, including transit, mail services, and utilities. Having lost most of their workers to the strike, newspapers quickly branded strikers as Bolsheviks, depicting them as bomb throwers in cartoons. Winnipeg's bosses formed the Citizens Committee of 1000 and declared the general strike a conspiracy led by alien scum. When the police sided with the strikers, they were fired and replaced in their entirety by specials used to break the strike. Workers were intransigent, and by the middle of June, the federal government ordered the arrest of strike leaders. When tens of thousands of workers gathered on June 21st for a demonstration at Market Square, they were charged by the Royal Mounted Police, armed with clubs and guns. Two strikers were killed, and scores more were injured in what is known as Bloody Saturday. Winnipeg was under military occupation, and the strike ended in heavy losses for the workers. But many strike leaders won regional political elections the following year, defeating the very forces that smashed their strike. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
That's it for this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, our roundup of highlights from just a few of the more than 100 Labor Radio shows and podcasts that make up the Labor Radio Podcast Network. We've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org, including complete versions of the shows you heard today. And you can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Patrick Dixon and Chris Bangert-Drowns, produced by me, and our social media guru, as always, is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net. Find out more on our website, laborradionetwork.org. Before we go, we really hope you enjoy the show as well as any of the Labor Radio and podcast shows we've introduced you to. Please help spread the word about the amazing and growing world of Labor Radio and podcast shows. You can like the show and share it on social media, sonic solidarity, if you will. Thanks very much. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show.